Hello and namaste. I'm Peter Furco, and this is Peter's podcast, where we talk about real yoga, actual happiness, and deep living. Thanks for joining me. Hello, and welcome to the Thanksgiving episode of Peter's podcast. What could be more fun than a day with pumpkin pie as a highlight? Yet Thanksgiving is a problematic holiday. There's the colonialism vis-a-vis Native American aspect of the holiday. There's the dealing with relatives who have differing views. There's the trickiness of bringing a date or not having a date, or having to decide which family members or friends you're going to spend the holiday with. There's the onslaught of Black Friday sales and the reframing of Thanksgiving as really the opening of the shopping season formerly known as certain religious holidays. We could go on, but let's not. Instead, let's talk about how you can reframe Thanksgiving as a day of actual happiness and deep living. I struggled for years with Thanksgivings that were a jumble of sports, splinter group conversations, and big emotional cooking extravaganzas. Usually, that's followed by blink-of-an-eye meals that left most of the group overstuffed and mentally focused on how to eat and appreciate more of what was so specially prepared. I don't mean to say any of that is bad, per se. A nice conversation with a family member or new acquaintance, or seeing how much kids have grown, can be great fun and warm quality time. It just felt so unlike giving thanks. And I felt like we spend too much time wanting more and too little giving thanks for what we have. There were a couple awkward years when I tried to get up the courage to propose something a little more special. But being introverted by nature, it's hard for me to even call people on the phone, so commandeering a holiday meal didn't happen right off. Then I remembered something Wendy told me about Russian drinking habits. While Americans and many other cultures have a fixed toast, like cheers, Russians routinely make a toast about the moment or a person. I broke through my shyness obstacle by bringing that fact to light at the Thanksgiving table and made my toast. One or two others followed suit, but that was that. My birthday, November 24th, orbits Thanksgiving, and one year at my sister's house, I used my birthday as the excuse for making a special request as we sat down to dinner. I said, "For my birthday, I'd like to go around the table and have us each say what we're thankful for." The result was incredibly sweet and sincere, and just the deepening I was looking for. I and one or two others even teared up. I had done Thanksgiving with close friends that felt great because we always talk deeply about things, but this was a special warmth for a big family dinner. I tried it the next year with the other side of our family, and had surprisingly good results again. I think people want a reason to mark important moments, but we don't have natural ways to do it in our modern day-to-day. So we turn to Facebook, or we let someone on TV do it. This year, I invite you to use me as an excuse. Say, "This guy on a podcast suggested we go around the table and share something we're thankful for." If you feel like it, you can leave me a comment about how it went at peterspodcast.simplecast.fm, or just enjoy the deep moment. I'm thankful for all of you who listen to and support the conversations on Peter's podcast. What are you thankful for? Elizabeth Chubbuck is a New York City business professional with a long-standing yoga practice. After studying at Trinity College in Connecticut, she spent 4 years working for Hearst magazines at Cosmo and at Good Housekeeping. Her side interest in gourmet cheese led her to Murray's Cheese Shop in Greenwich Village, where she spent nearly 3 years volunteering in their classroom and eventually accepted a job there. She's currently the Senior Vice President of Sales and Marketing at Murray's. Through her professional journey, Elizabeth has consistently turned to yoga as a way to find space and joy, and she says it helps her in all the areas of her life. I stopped by Murray's in Long Island City to talk to Elizabeth about yoga and business. I hope you enjoy our conversation. Hi, Elizabeth.
Hi, Peter.
How are you?
I'm great, thanks. How are you?
I am so good because I'm in Murray's Cheese. And just being close to this much cheese is like samadhi, the highest state of meditation.
Now you know what my everyday is like.
Yeah, that's so great.
You weren't too put off by the intense aroma of cabbage and mushrooms and socks as you walked in the door?
This is my people's food.
You do. You've always liked the stinky cheeses. So.
It's true. Yeah. So I'm so glad you had the time in the busy schedule here at Murray's. You just told me you're gearing up for Christmas already. So everybody's working 24 hours a day down in the delivery and distribution center, and you guys are keeping it all going.
That's what we do. I mean, the holidays are a busy, busy time. People eat cheese all year round, but
I do.
Yeah, me too. I eat cheese all day long, morning, noon, and night. But it's definitely a big gifting item, and as like holiday celebrations increase between work parties and social gatherings and actual holiday specific festivities, the consumption of cheese just spikes, goes through the roof.
Yeah, and what's your actual job title here? Boss of everyone.
I'm in charge of a lot.
Yeah.
I'm Senior Vice President of Marketing and Sales.
Great.
For whatever that means.
Congratulations.
Thanks.
Yeah.
It's pretty fun.
Yeah, and at the same time, you've done all this intensive yoga training and practicing, and that's why we're talking today.
Yeah.
I wanted to find out how your practice works and also what it does in terms of your working life, because part of what I'd like to cover on the podcast is this notion of deep living, that yoga brings you the possibility of actual happiness and deep living. So
awesome.
That's where we are. Yeah.
It's a good place to be.
Yeah. So tell us a little bit about your own finding yoga and how it progressed.
So my first introduction to yoga was very peripheral when I was quite young, probably 10 or 11. And my parents, I had a friend whose mother was this like very eccentric hippie artist dancer. And she taught yoga classes in what was called White Street Studio in Urbana, Illinois, Central Illinois. And I was very curious at like 10 years old about yoga classes. My parents at the time were...
we call that karma.
Karma, exactly. Karma. My parents were, they were Christians. My father had been a sort of founding member of a non-denominational Protestant church that was very, very kind of came out of the sort of like hippie movement. People wore Birkenstocks. We played a lot of acoustic guitars and had sing-alongs and did liturgical dancing and met in a gymnasium. You know, it was very DIY and laid back. But at the same time, the idea of yoga to them seemed like somehow a threat. So it seemed they were concerned that it might have occult leanings and that it would be against Christianity. So I didn't get to take my yoga classes. I didn't even
That still exists a little bit. I hear that from time to time from Christian circles that yoga is a religion and it's,
I think they like associate it with like the new age movement, quote unquote. And therefore it just is sort of seen as other and even like today when it's so pervasive as like in the sort of wellness fitness space and is in many cases kind of devoid of the like the foundational philosophies and this true spirit of it. I think there's still a lot of misconceptions out there about what yoga really is.
Yeah. So you got this little taste or preview of coming attractions, as Alan Finger says.
A preview of coming attractions. My curiosity was spiked.
Yeah.
And then when I was in college, my freshman year, there was a Kundalini yoga class that was offered as like a 4-credit class.
Wow.
And I thought, oh, here's my chance to take it. And it was a class that I was taking for a letter grade, which meant that my dedication to the practice, ongoing every day for a long period of time.
Maybe we should do that at the studio, give grades.
Give grades. it was an interesting experience because I was at a time in my life in my college career where my sort of extracurricular activities were really working against me as a human and individual, and certainly me as an aspiring yogini.
Uh-huh.
And I always would miss the class because I would sleep in. I'd be out late drinking, partying, dancing the night before, and then didn't want to get up for class. And my, you know, I had to make it up by, of course, reading lectures or reading, goodness, what is it? The Joy of Yoga. What is the, I can't remember.
The Light of Yoga. Light on Yoga.
Right. So I had to make up missed classes.
Iyengar's book.
Reading chapters of Iyengar's book, The Light on Yoga. And then writing essays and about it, sort of recaps. But what was interesting is that we did a lot of sort of intense, long mantra-based meditations, oftentimes with repetitive movements, seated, but repetitive movements with the hands, arms, you know, chanting. And whether I realized it or not, I was learning things about how to manage the connection between my mind and my body and how that related to my ability to sleep at night or to pay attention to my studies at the library the next day. It had an impact. Even in that year, I learned how to conquer some insomnia by lulling my mind away from the busyness that it was sort of habitually drawn to.
Right.
And actually just asking my thoughts to behave differently.
Yeah, and that's such a common problem among people in our modern world where distraction and keeping your mind moving is what everyone's selling you.
Right, it's sort of the status quo.
Yeah.
And an incredibly, incredibly dangerous and deceptive
model
to buy into too much.
Yeah.
So I took the class. I ended up getting a very good grade in it.
Yay.
And then I never did yoga again until I graduated college, and I had joined Crunch Gym. Was making barely any money, but of course going to the gym or having some kind of connection to fitness was important.
Right.
But I was ultimately not that motivated to lift weights or run on a treadmill, and I started going to yoga classes there because I was had remembered having good experiences in yoga, but really it was because I got to lay on the floor at the end of class and I felt like my core muscles were being developed. I was gaining strength and flexibility, but I didn't have to work that hard.
Right. There's a t-shirt I see in class sometime. I come for the Shavasana.
Well, we always, yeah. most people do, at least to some extent.
Yeah.
I mean, Shavasana is what it's sort of like that. It is the moment of ultimate stillness. It is the moment where your mind has been exhausted by focusing on the practice and following the guidance of the teacher, and your body is fatigued and ready for a rest as well. And you lie down and get to be still and seek that kind of moment of nothingness or samadhi without having to work hard to get there because you've already done the work.
Right, right. It's the letting go part.
So then at Crunch Gym, I discovered another teacher at one point, Rajiv.
Rajiv,
who was doing his teacher training at Ishta, but I didn't know that at the time. All I knew about Rajiv was that he had a 2-meter arm span, and he taught a yoga class on Saturday mornings that left me with the sense of just unlimited potential for hope. And I was going through a terrible breakup. I was very depressed. I was in my early 20s. I was worried about health insurance. And I remember getting up every Saturday. I would go to his class, and then I would walk over to Eno, which was like a tiny little Italian cafe that was on Bedford Street in the West Village. And I would sit at the bar, and I would order a cappuccino and a glass of orange juice. And Patty Smith, who lives in the neighborhood, would oftentimes be sitting next to me. And of course, I didn't even know who she was. But I would write in my journal, and I would write in a way that was a practice in cultivating mindfulness and just paying attention to details of the present moment. And I didn't realize at the time, but like the particular practice he was guiding me towards in those Saturday morning classes really lent itself to being seeped in the present. And all I knew was that at the end of those writing sessions on yoga mornings, I would feel joyful in a period of my life where I was struggling with so many personal things.
Yeah.
And, you know, my family knows I referred to those days I was cultivating joy, sort of actively moving towards things that would bring me joyfulness.
Yeah.
So then I guess probably in 2008,
Rajiv and I were taking that same training together because he was in the same teacher training that I was. And Rajiv taught me about the importance of watching one's blood pressure when you do forward bends. As in one of our practice sessions, we were standing next to each other, and not only does he have the wingspan, but he's tall, right? So he stood up next to me. We were both standing up from a forward bend, and Rajiv came down like a tree right next to me. It's great to have those, like, you read this stuff in the book, contraindications, blood pressure, you know?
Right.
But to experience it from someone, it makes it stick.
That's fine. Now he's a medical doctor, so
right.
He could probably advise on contraindications and blood pressure for forward bends in an even more clinical way.
Exactly.
So then in 2008, the Crunch Gym location that I was going to down in Soho was closing. And Rajiv, in one of the classes towards the end of that location's existence, told us that he taught also at Ishta, which was a studio on 11th Street. So I was living in Soho at the time. Ishta was, you know, I was interested in things that were convenient,
mm-hmm.
and Ishta was very convenient.
Yeah.
And so I started going. I think my first classes were with Jean and Sarah.
Mm-hmm.
So Sarah taught like a Monday night class, and I don't remember when Jean's classes were, but I remember I went there and I don't have any aha moments from those early days of the practice, but a year later, I was changing jobs from advertising sales. I was working previously at Good Housekeeping magazine, and I was transitioning to my job at Murray's, and I was really unhappy in that transition. And I remember chatting with Sarah and Jean about the potential of coming to work for Ishta. They were looking for an assistant and, you know, sort of didn't really know what they were looking for exactly. And I didn't really know what I was looking for exactly. And I just remember that going into that meeting with them, I had really spent time thinking about what I had observed in yoga and what I would want to say to them that would maybe impress them.
Mm-hmm.
And Ardha Uttanasana is a position as a pose that has long brought me tremendous meaning. Half of a forward bend.
Or flat back if you're in a Bikram practice.
Flat back.
Yeah.
And at some point in that year or the first 2 years of being at Ishta, I started getting these like visions almost of when I would practice, this sort of like sense of connection into something that was like much more profound than anything that was happening in that room or anything that I really knew in my sort of present day physical experience of the
mm-hmm.
world. And Ardha Uttanasana was this position that really resonated with me.
Mm.
And it was something, you know, I'm trying to remember exactly what it was. Now it's just like such second nature that I feel empowered in that pose.
Right. It's so beautiful too because it's so simple. It's not even a whole forward bend.
No,
it's half of a forward bend and yet so potent.
Right.
Yeah.
I think that when I stopped trying to do it with my hands on the ground, when
uh-huh.
I started thinking more about the integrity of the strength of my back and this idea that I started sort of visualizing in Ardha Uttanasana that I was taking the shape of something that was capable of supporting tremendous weight.
Mm-hmm.
Something that was like structurally sound and of the earth in a way, like a plateau or like the flat top.
Yeah, like a butte.
Mountain or
mm-hmm.
butte, exactly. I found it incredibly grounding and empowering. And so I remember mentioning to Sarah and Jean at the time that I felt like Ardha Uttanasana was a pose that was highly underrated and that it wasn't just something that you passed through in the middle of vinyasa, but that it was something that had the capacity to convey profound experience and teach. And I think they were sort of like, huh. And I was kind of like, huh. And so then I just kept going to Ishta. I kept going forever.
I hope you're enjoying my conversation with Elizabeth. We'll continue in a minute. I want to let you know about some opportunities to study and practice with me. I'm very excited to announce a summer retreat led by Ulrika Norbury, Wendy Newton, and myself in Brittany, France this summer, August 14 to 18. It's called Yoga and the Art of Living Creatively. Details are coming soon. You can email me at peter@peterfurco.com for details. I'm also teaching a meditation training with my own teacher, Alan Finger, and Sarah Finger, who appeared on a previous podcast. The meditation training is in December. I'm teaching a 300-hour teacher training at Ishta in January. I also teach regular asana and meditation classes there. See ishtayoga.com for details. Finally, I'm using Patreon to offer opportunities to work with me one-on-one. You can subscribe for a mantra session or for an hour video private. Of course, as they say on public radio, I hope you'll subscribe at any level just because you value Peter's podcast. Go to patreon.com/peterspodcast. Make a Thanksgiving pledge. I'm thankful in advance. Here's the rest of our talk.
I never took meditation for a long time because, of course, I was, you know, meditation classes were, all the classes as one-offs were expensive and I couldn't afford the monthly unlimited, and I was sort of like, well, why am I going to pay money to sit in a room and not do anything for a long time?
Right.
And then it must have been probably in like 2011 or 12, I got injured. And I didn't realize prior to that injury, it had never occurred to me that yoga could be a conduit for injury in the body.
And that one could hurt oneself doing yoga.
Right, that one could hurt oneself while doing it. It hadn't occurred to me. And I had pretty intense hamstring attachment issues on both legs, aka yoga butt. And it was deeply painful. I couldn't sit, I couldn't walk, I couldn't practice. And I decided that maybe I should go to meditation because I was really missing the things that I had been, the sense of connection and sort of what I was learning about how to inhabit my own body throughout a variety of different experiences. And so I started going to Al's meditation classes. I would, you know, because I had these injuries, I was leaving work periodically for, physical therapy.
Right.
So every once in a while I would sort of either schedule a full
metaphysical therapy,
metaphysical therapy, or every once in a while I'd schedule like a full day off so I could go. And the effects of it were pretty immediate and profound for me. I immediately came back to my daily life after meditation classes and realized that I could organize my thoughts and I immediately came back from meditation and to my work environment and found that I could immediately and quickly access an organization of thought that allowed me to convey and delegate things or help break down projects into actual steps or project manage really quickly.
Right.
It was just like suddenly I had access to this thing.
Yeah. And I'm going to insert a little bit of Ayurveda here because your nature is pitta, and doing that kind of thing is what you do, right? That's the gift of pitta, being organized and getting things done and leading people and all of this stuff. But what often gets in the way is the vata. So it's like pitta is like fire and determination, and vata is movement and change. And when there's too much movement in one's mind, it makes it hard to access that other thing.
Exactly.
So your meditation was helping you clear your mind from all the movement, and then you could step into what was your nature.
Right. That's sort of like the clarity of the light that is provided by the concentration of the fire. Yeah, without a doubt. So that was all happening. I had started taking your classes, Peter, before that, probably. I must have been like in the second year that I had was practicing at Ishta, or even in that first year, because I remember there was a lot of there were two more aha moments for me in the years before I started doing the meditation, before I went into teacher training. One of them was in Jean's class, and it was in Downward Dog, and I had been
Gina Kerner.
Yeah, I had been home with my parents at in Wisconsin and spending time with their dog, and really just like lying on the floor, like wrestling with the dog, cuddling with the dog, just like letting the dog be its true nature and fully express itself, and just kind of responding and encouraging that to happen.
Yeah.
And I remember observing him do downward dog and then upward dog. And I went back to New York the next week and I went to Gene Kerner's class and we did downward dog and upward dog. And Lobo was a dog. He was right there inside of me,
Revelation.
Like kind of carrying me through the poses. Yeah. And that for me opened up this.
His name was Lobo?
His name was Lobo. Aww. Wolf, yeah. Very sweet dog.
Yeah.
And that kind of opened up this like connection, this sort of like intuitive, like earthy animal space connection to the practice that was an immediate evolution of how I connected to it in terms of just personal expression and like stepping out of the restraint of identity as a human.
Yeah.
Or as like an individual, professional, woman, whatever.
Yeah, I often say when we're doing those poses in class, you know, dogs do them, cats do them. Right. They don't do them because they're doing yoga.
Right.
Like, I wonder if my downward dog is good. They're doing it because it feels like the thing to do.
Yeah.
And they just do it the way that feels good.
The way that feels good.
Like, can we do that?
Yes. Yeah.
Let's do that now.
And so, and for so long, that's what I looked for. Can I just do this in the way that feels good, that just opens up my body, right? And I didn't know it at the time because I hadn't gone through the training and learned about the seven segments and the chakras and the way energy moves through the body. But that was essentially what I was doing, was allowing my body's own instinct to create those openings.
To feel the energy.
To feel it.
Yeah, that inner feeling that is energy.
Yep. Yeah. And so then the third kind of specific moment for me was in one of your classes. And it was in one of your classes after I'd been going to your classes for a long time. And the thing that I have always like really respected about you as a teacher, and find it, it's a unique quality. And of course you have your own unique style of doing it too, but the way you kind of playfully lead asana and then lace philosophy and concepts and ideas throughout it and use the physical form to illustrate lessons or ideas. And it was in...
I should put that on my book.
You should. I'm happy to blurb it for you. I've blurbed cheese books. I can blurb a yoga book. I have like slightly less credentials formally in that second. We were in Uttanasana. No, not Uttanasana. Utkatasana.
Uh-huh,
so
chair.
Chair pose.
Yeah.
And
or the thunderbolt, some people call that in different schools.
Yeah.
Because your body is shaped like a zigzag.
Awesome.
Yeah.
We were there and you were holding us there. And, you know, my muscles were tired and I didn't like it. And I was just kind of shaking. And you really used svadhyaya, self-study. You know, you asked us to say, where are you in this pose? Like, what is your mind saying to you about this pose? What are your thoughts? What thoughts are coming up? Is it possible that the thoughts that you're having don't define your experience of it? Or they don't, or maybe is it possible that the thoughts you're having don't have to define your experience of chair pose? That perhaps what could define your experience of chair pose is your ability to observe your thoughts, observe your reactions to it, and allow them to exist alongside a different experience of being in the pose. So your judgments, your ideas, discomfort, etc. Like, can you just identify what those things are? Say, hey, I see you over there. I got it. I know what you're talking about.
Mm-hmm.
But like, you're not the only thing that's happening here. And then just focus on the actual physical sensation, the experience of the energetic experience of being in the pose objectively.
Yeah.
You know, it is hard. That's okay that it's hard.
Yeah.
You don't have to hate it because it's hard.
Yeah. And they say you teach what you learn. And I had to do that with chair pose because I hated it. And then I had a student tell me, I really love this pose. And I was like, oh, shoot, I guess I have to learn. My students can't outdo me in this.
Right. There you go. You were competitive yoga.
Yes.
So that was a huge thing for me. And that was really a moment. Once I sort of hit those two sort of secondary aha moments or revelations in myself that had come to me through the practice, really pointed me into this direction that like there was a lot more for me to learn from the practice, and that the things I was learning about it far exceeded any expectation I could have had around what I would gain. Mm-hmm. And that was when, so then the injuries occurred, and I think I was probably at that point open to going to meditation. And then suddenly it was just like, I mean, Al always talks about it. He's like, suddenly things just come to you.
Mm-hmm.
I found right after I started meditating, I found that if I was mid-sentence and I lost my train of thought or I couldn't recall a specific word, that all I had to do was just pause, just stop, wait, open my mind, and it would just come right back. So whether, you know, and then I also found that that same kind of ability to pause and do nothing in a moment, create, it's almost like you create a, you just erase the chalkboard.
Yeah. Right?
You just take the eraser and just wipe everything off just for a second. And then once you've created that space, the answer pops right back in.
Yeah, it's beautiful.
Yeah. So I'd find my keys after I, you know, like couldn't find my keys, just pause for a second.
Yeah.
Remember the last time I had them, and it would lead me right to where they were.
Yeah. Yeah. Such a practical practice.
I like to do things and learn things that I can then do
use.
Stuff with.
Yeah, totally. I mean, that's what I love about the way that we practice yoga. That, I mean, some people are devotional by nature, and so they can be as devotional as they want. That's great. But yoga is not just that kind of practice. It's a totally practical way, like the way, like the Tao. You know, it's the way, a way of working with life and accessing this other aspect of what we are so that our life is richer, that we have tools to move through the various challenges that we encounter. So we evolve
yep.
into beings that have more joy.
Right.
To use your phrase.
That have right? more joy.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Within this tumultuous, crazy existence that's called life.
And I think sometimes that like the you know, for me, joy is oftentimes founded on the ability to experience a sense of wonder
mm-hmm.
or to be sort of overwhelmed by like the simple beauty or the kind of simple elegance of things around me. And like joy is not based on complexity. It is not based on expensive experiences and things. It is
unless
it's a really good blue cheese. At the point, I've got a discount personally, so it's not that expensive for me personally.
Yeah.
It's why I chose this as my career.
I mean, just the simple wonder of things, and there's a naivete implied in wonder,
right?
You know, that it's something that takes one by surprise.
And what's interesting is that like we don't have room in our like experiential capacity or observational capacity to engage with that simplicity when we are caught in the fast moving water wheel of modern life.
Yeah.
Or the digital water. You know, this is sort of churning constant input from outside sources that we're not necessarily even curating that well.
Right.
As individuals.
And the practical tool or gift that yoga gives is this sort of supercharged moment that you can get the space, you can get the time, you can get the break within an active life.
Yep, absolutely. And that's, I mean, that is, I think that when I was doing those like cultivating joy practice, that was something that I had found without knowing what it was.
Right.
I had sort of found this practice that slowed me down, and it slowed me down. It created space, but it because it was an ishta practice, right? Because it had tantra as a piece of it, it was encouraging me to take those things out into the world and live them.
Yeah,
and actively seek them.
Yeah. So let me ask you this, because you are unique in some ways in terms of a yoga practice, because you've were practiced in a gym, you practiced at a studio, you were focused on asana, then you became interested in meditation, you took a teacher training, two teacher trainings,
yes.
with a little space in between, right?
I think 2 or 3 years in between.
Yeah, and then you've done a fair amount of going on retreats where you got intensive bits of yoga.
Yeah.
So what would you say were the sort of highlights in terms of the various differences that you got from all those ways of taking on yoga. And you have a home practice
and
as well.
And home practice, yeah. So the my first teacher training, which was the 200-hour training that I did at Ishta, was for me, I went into that teacher training with injuries all over my body. I had both, you know, the yoga, but the hamstring attachment injuries on both sides. My wrists were in rough shape as well. And Svadhyaya was
self-study
was the overarching theme of that. And I had been interested in understanding what motivated me, what drove me to do things on a more sort of like psychoanalytical perspective, but I hadn't considered how my prakriti, right, or like my sort of natural tendencies manifested themselves in the way I lived physically in the world. And when I took that level of self-study into my yoga practice, in the teacher training, especially with those injuries, I really had to search for and identify my patterns in asana that were related back to that nature, and to decide whether or not they were serving me, and figure out how I could help them evolve. Right? How I could evolve them.
Like natural tendencies to want to do it right, want to push, want to achieve, and all of that.
Right.
But being now reflective about it.
Exactly.
To see, how do I redefine those drives to suit you?
Right. So, like, concrete example is that I've always been relatively flexible, and I'm quite strong, and I'm petite. And so that combination of things allows me to have quick access to advanced yoga poses or deep forward bends or hamanasana splits, that maybe actually aren't right for my body. Maybe the depth at which I was going to them weren't right for my body. And in my case in particular, my flexibility gave me access to things before I had learned to truly engage my muscles around it to make sure that I was protecting my tendons, my ligaments, like all of the other interior things that are doing a lot of work.
Right.
And so, that I think in that period of time, I really focused on how do I get comfortable just going halfway?
Mm-hmm.
How does halfway become the thing I'm striving to achieve?
Wow.
How does restraint become the goal? How does a lesser expression of the poses become the thing that validates me?
Right.
And I didn't have a choice. We were practicing multiple times a week, and I had to figure out how to allow my body to recover in the midst of that.
Right.
And it was a profound experience, in learning how to rein myself in order to give myself the space that I needed, in that particular instance, physically to recover, and sort of like energetically or psychically or intellectually, the sort of analogy is the space to kind of let ideas, concepts, knowledge sink roots, sprout branches, grow leaves, develop, as opposed to just kind of plowing through.
Yeah.
Quickly
ticking things off.
Yeah. Or moving through things quickly, even if I was building a system as I went, and not just necessarily ticking them off the box, but like really thinking that I was thinking through it, but without the space to consider the knowledge that I already had or the input I had, and decide based on that input whether or not my first instinct at a strategy or approach was truly the right one.
Mm-hmm.
So it was like I kind of got to know myself in a way where I could negotiate.
Right. So training is this longer form of doing self-study and applying it and seeing the result of that.
Yep.
And then what about like doing retreat kinds of things?
Oh, goodness.
More intensive and short.
Retreats. So I've been to specifically to Mexico with mm-hmm. Alan and Sarah three times, so mm-hmm. 3 years in a row. And then I also went on a women's retreat with Sarah and Kristen Leal mm-hmm. For a short weekend. The retreats that I went on in Mexico were, I mean, like a complete suspension of reality, and this complete immersion in yoga and the practice, but also like an immersion in community and family in a way that was, I mean, it's kind of hard to even describe what it feels like, because you're with your teachers 24/7. You're with people who are there all for the same reason, different levels of like knowledge and interaction or established practice, but you're all there with the same intention and the same, well, everyone has different intentions, but you're all there to practice and to study and to be immersed in this experience. And it's, you know, it's kind of like, I don't know, like confirmation bias, like in the best way possible, because everything around you reinforces kind of like what you're there for and what you're learning and what you know. And it's also challenging, you know, you are with one group.
The dynamic of that.
Yeah, the dynamic of that. Yeah. There can sometimes be, you know, things that happen. We every time I've been to Mexico though, it's been a pretty like seamless and magical experience. And the, you know, the value of so Al, I think, teaches the Mahabhuta or Mahamudra mm-hmm. meditation there. Mm-hmm. And it's a complicated and in-depth meditation that he likes to teach specifically on retreat, where he gets to be present with the students the whole way through, and they're not kind of like stepping back into the world and taking pieces of it on their own. The experience of spending a week saturated in that environment for me means that I have this new connotation associated with my practice mm-hmm. that is anchored in these incredibly positive experiences that I've had, you know, almost like ethereal. I mean, it's like, I can't stop saying enough good things about it. So I'll be sitting in my apartment in the middle of winter, sitting down to meditate, and I'll just call forth the images, the feelings, the memories of being in Mexico or being on retreat with them, and allow that to kind of, you know, buoy my meditation, like guide it and carry it forward.
Like a point of reference that you know that that's possible.
Yeah. Sometimes I'll do yoga nidra and I'll invite images of Mexico into the various parts of my body. So the colors, the faces of the people, like the dog that's there, the beach, mm-hmm. the scent, and just like paint myself from the inside out with the pieces of that trip and that experience.
Yeah.
That for me, it's like it's immediate antidepressant in the winter, especially.
That's awesome. Wendy and I and Ulrika Norbury are going to do a retreat in near Rouen in France this summer.
Awesome.
So we're just starting to plan what we're going to do. So it's very exciting. To think about.
Yeah, that's amazing.
Yeah.
That's like really amazing.
Yeah. So, and I think it'll be a pretty international group to go. So, yeah.
Maybe I'll make the French-speaking boyfriend join.
Yeah.
join that one.
That would be fun. Yeah. And there's going to be a creative aspect to it. So,
that's very cool.
Yeah.
That's very cool.
Since he's an artist.
Yes. Nice.
Yeah. So, What are you finding? So you just described a little bit about your home practice too, mm-hmm. that you draw on a home practice, and you were telling me before we started recording that, especially now that business is getting ramped up, it's challenging to have a home practice. What are your ways that you keep yourself going with that? I know I see you at Ishtis from time to time for that little like tune-up.
Yeah, the tune-ups are really important. I think when I'm struggling to, so I have for the most part, I have a daily meditation practice at home that has been in place since December of 2004, I guess. I think that's right. Oh, sorry, December of 2014. So that daily meditation practice has been there for about 3 years. And occasionally life, you know, starts to go off the rails, and it's hard to it's hard to stick to it. It's hard to keep that rhythm going. It's hard to find time. It's hard to get out of bed early enough to do it. And I find that being able to plug back into my teachers and come back to the community is a way that I know I can, it's like swimming from one life raft to the next.
Yeah.
When I'm struggling at home, I know that if I can just get back into the studio, that it will help me, it'll help me stay anchored and give me that like additional boost or motivation to stay present with the practice on my own.
I think so many people are struggling, like searching for community in the world now, you know, and it is true that like the having connection with teachers, and the teachers of course have connections with many students, so it creates this community, like you were saying about the retreat. Everyone's there for the same, not exact same thing, but for that same juice of what tools I can take into life that makes it more full of joy, full of wonder, full of this magic, you know, things occur.
Week-long Shakti cocktail.
Yeah.
Yeah. And I think that the community is deeply important, because especially in a practice like Ishta, when you've like, and I've done now 500 hours of teacher training and various other training modules, I have a lot of intense knowledge about it. And that knowledge becomes, it sort of gets pushed away in a box in the back corner of underneath my bed and gets dusty if I don't bring it out and examine it amongst people who recognize the things that I'm considering and the things that I'm talking about. And, you know, as much as I want to, as much as I will chew, you know, my boyfriend or my parents' ears off about, you know, the sort of parallels between samadhi and, you know, with my dad and my uncle who are, you know, men of God with like, with, you know, religious experiences or experiencing God and things like that. There's something that's like deeply comforting about being able to sit with people who have studied the same lineage or even just know the same things.
Yeah.
My best friend from childhood, who I hadn't seen in maybe like almost 10 years, I got together with last, like about a year ago. Turns out she's done 500 hours of teacher training.
Really?
And we immediately started talking about the doshas and Ayurveda. And she came from a very different school, but we could relate to each other along those lines. And it was, it felt like coming home.
Yeah.
And there's, you know, there's a level of like comfort and security and groundedness that happens in that space that is, it feeds you. And then you go back to your regular life or you go back to your weekly practice and you have a little bit more fuel for it.
Right.
You know, I also just find that like, I like to be structured. I like things to be consistent. And one of the things I've struggled with in my own practice is that if I, so my practice is I do Ishta Diksha typically, although I'll do other meditations as well, but I sit for 20 minutes most mornings, like at least 5 mornings during the week before work, eat breakfast, get showered, get dressed, go into my bedroom, sit, meditate, you know, premeditated Vasana meditation, Shavasana, you know, grounding mantras, Shavasana.
You get an A.
I get an A. I'm trying to get an A. And so when I don't do that in the morning, it took me a while to get comfortable accepting the fact that I could do it at another point in the day. For me, there's a benefit to doing it consistently every morning, that consistency of it and starting my day off with it is the right way for me to practice. But if I can't do it, then I still get benefits from doing it, you know.
Well, if you have consistency, then you can fool around with it. It's like when you're trying to build consistency, if you don't do it here, it's easy to not ever get to it.
Right.
You know?
Yeah. So. And I also find that, like, you know, there, I think that people often, and I know myself, like, I want things to just be fixed. I want to, I, you know, and this is something I feel like I keep bumping my head against personally in the, over the last couple of years. Like, I want the work that I've done on my practice and my studies of yoga to just, like, be enough. And for me to be able to, like, you know, like, do maintenance and then, like, go about my life and have the ideas continue to live within me and through me. And it doesn't work that way. And I have, you know, I've struggled in the last week in particular, have kind of fallen off the horse with meditation and had to keep kicking myself to get back on. Sometimes I'll just say, I can sit for 10 minutes. So I'll just sit for 10 minutes. I can just do Nadi Shodhana and sit for 3 minutes. I'll do that. I'll do whatever I can so that I just don't lose the thread completely. But I had noticed that I had like fallen into this pattern where I was very consumed by what wasn't working at various points in my life. And that when I would sit for meditation, that doubt, that frustration, that dissatisfaction would still creep back in. And I do acupuncture also. Mm-hmm. And the thing I love about acupuncture is just you lie still on them.
You receive it.
No, you don't have to do it. Yeah. I receive acupuncture. Yeah. I have an acupuncturist. It's a community place in Bushwick that's fantastic called Tiger Lily Holistic. Anyways, but what I love about acupuncture is lying there still without any input other than my own mind and body.
Yeah.
And my yoga practice comes out then too, because I observe what's happening in my mind. And this week I observed myself, you know, in that repetitive loop of what's wrong, what's not working, why it's disaster, why everything, nothing's going to work out. And I just stopped myself and I said, first of all, I said, why am I doing this? Then I said, can I just say to myself, those are interesting observations, and leave it at that? And for me, it was like, I have got to get back into Ishta to connect with my asana practice there, because that for me was like, oh, I've disconnected from that again.
Right.
So I've long...
And the asana is so nice because it's not just in your head. And your heads are so good at like tricking us into going this way or that way down some road. But getting back in your body too, it's grounding.
Yep.
Literally.
Super grounding. And it grounds the ideas.
Yeah.
Right? It grounds those ideas. And that was, it was important for me to see that, to remember it.
Mm-hmm.
You know, it's like I think you said it once, and I say it to people all the time. You don't break bad habits. You simply develop awareness of the habits that aren't serving you, and you develop better habits that slowly eclipse the bad habits. But in order to do that, you have to slow down.
Mm-hmm.
You have to have some empty spaces in the brain, in the mind, in your calendar, you know, to let that awareness bubble up.
Yeah.
And then to consider what a better habit might become.
Right.
What a better habit might be.
And it's so hard. Like our whole culture is kind of pitta, you know, we're all trying to do. And it's so great that you're finding these places that let you like officially not do, like laying on the acupuncture table or being in Shavasana. But that's what we need to find.
And it comes back to that experience of 200 hour and learning how to adapt my practice around injuries.
Yeah.
So this like an active cultivation of satisfaction in getting, you know, not going as far as I could.
Yeah.
Actively kind of slowing down and making that the goal.
Yeah, even all the way till where there's no thinking going around so other stuff can bubble through.
That's the best.
Yeah.
That is the best.
Cool. Awesome. Well, you have a busy day, so I don't want to take too much of your time.
Thanks for coming out to
Long Island City. I really appreciate hearing your experiences and putting them into the context of a work life.
Thanks.
Yeah.
You've played a tremendous role in the sort of formation of all of it, and your teachings are dotted throughout the minds of people in this office, whether they realize it or not.
Awesome.
So when I got to walk you through the office on the way to sit down here and have this conversation, you were seeing students of yours who've never seen your face and didn't know who you are before today.
Well, that's one of the joys of teaching too, to know that it continues on.
That's the lineage, right?
Yeah, exactly. Yeah, and you're a great teacher. So
thanks, Peter.
Namaste.
Namaste.
That's our episode for today. I hope you enjoyed it. Remember, patreon.com/peterspodcast. Lots of great stuff coming up. Come see me. Have a great Thanksgiving. Namaste.